and welcome to the ADHD Manual Podcast. My name is Abby Miner. I'm a marriage and family therapist, an ADHD certified clinical services provider, and a proud ADHDer. This is a podcast for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and those who love us, which covers pretty much everybody. Growing up with a colorful brain in a black and white world can make us feel like aliens. The manual we've been given to guide us through life doesn't have any diagrams of the parts we've been given. I've decided to stop throwing away my parts and start throwing away this useless manual to write my own. So kick off your shoes, have a seat, and take a break from fitting yourself into a mold that's not your shape. You belong here. Allies, welcome to the ADHD planet. ADHDers, welcome home. Welcome back to the ADHD Manual Podcast. Today I have a guest with me, Ronan McGovern, and I thought I'd let him introduce himself. So you want to tell us a little bit about you and maybe how we found each other?
Yeah. So my name is Ronan McGovern. I work in a bank called AIB Bank in Ireland. The reason we came to contact is because some of the advocacy work I'm doing on behalf of neurodiversity, and I suppose ADHD in particular. Over the last 2 years, I've done a lot of volunteer work advocating for neurodiverse people, especially in the context of corporations and business. And that's Abby. Somehow during the work, I came across your work, and that's how we connected. Myself, I was diagnosed with ADHD combined type in 1996 while I was a student at the Stanford Business School. I was diagnosed by a classmate who recognized my ADHD and the way I presented myself in class.
Oh, wow. Nice. Good friend, huh?
Yeah. She's a doctor. So she's a doctor who also knew a lot about, psychiatry and behavioral sciences. So she had deep expertise.
That's a great distinction. Yeah. There are a lot of doctors, right, who don't quite have the training.
Yeah, you really need it, yeah.
Yeah. So did you ever seek any treatment? I'm curious about if you know about the difference between like diagnosis or treatment in Ireland versus the US.
Let's take diagnosis first. In my generation, probably I'm guessing 98% of people never got diagnosed in my generation. Nowadays, hopefully through the schools, maybe 20% of kids are diagnosed. And that's a lot better than 98% not being diagnosed. In the States, it's definitely a lot better. And I suspect, I don't know, Abby, I guess, my guess is maybe in the States, kids today, maybe there might be a 60% diagnosis rate. And for people of my generation, whereas in Ireland, it was 98% did not get diagnosed. I suspect in America, it might have been like 70%. So in other words, like, the States was probably three decades ahead of Ireland in this particular work, I think.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Was it difficult, like, growing up with undiagnosed? Or, like, was there any talk about ADHD when you were growing up, or just none?
No, the first I really heard of it was when I was in my 30s as a student at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. That's the first time when my classmate came over after class and said, "Roland, by the way, I think you have ADHD." I'd never even heard of ADHD. Never heard of it.
Wow. What was it like learning about it and hearing that?
Yeah, it was kind of like what it's like. It's like hearing news for the first time about something that's very strange. Let's say like the Star Wars, you know, the Star Trek movies. You hear something about a strange new world and you're kind of wondering, you're kind of think, God, there could be something in this. What is this thing called ADHD? I've never heard of it before. This person seems to be very confident I have it. I wonder what this is all about. So it was a kind of sense of wonderment and just curiosity as to what this woman was talking about.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, and you were part of a research project or volunteer work that we'll get to in a minute, but you probably had some experience like researching ADHD. Were there any resources that like made it click for you or really were helpful?
Yeah, so I think what happened was after that, then through the Stanford Stanford on-campus health center called Cowell Health Center, they referred me to a local specialist psychologist where I did, I think, like two sets of maybe 5-hour tests. And there I got formally diagnosed as having combined type ADHD. So that was 1996. And then I suppose in the months and years after that, I just was very curious to keep learning more about it. And the more I learned, the more I was curious. And I think it was taken to a whole other level over the last 18 months to 2 years when I began to do this social volunteer work in collaboration with Stanford.
Yeah, right. Wow, awesome. Yeah, I totally relate to that, just curiosity, needing to just gobble up everything I could find.
Yeah.
Things were starting to finally make sense. Or I was also diagnosed in adulthood. So
Yeah,
makes a lot of stuff fit together, right?
Yeah.
And did you mention you're writing a book about your experience?
Yeah, so here's, I mean, maybe I'll start off. Yes, I am. So I suppose the thing about the book is a work in progress, and I'm kind of hoping I'll have it published by the end of the year. But just to go back for a minute to the social, to the volunteer work, in February of 2019, I was invited to go and work at the Stanford Medical School, at the School of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, as a scholar. So I spent 6 months at the medical school, doing two major things. Firstly, advocating for neurodiversity amongst corporations. In other words, to try and promote neurodiversity at corporations, especially in the tech companies in Silicon Valley. And then I also advocated on behalf of neurodiversity amongst the seven different schools at Stanford. And so that's what I spent most of my 6 months doing. And then I came back to work then after 6 months at the medical school. Then if you fast forward to June of 2020, I volunteered to do an innovation sprint in collaboration with Stanford Business School, where my project, I focused on cognitive diversity. And what I did over the 3 months of the sprint of June, July, and August was I hired, I recruited 80 other fellow volunteers to work for the summer on neurodiversity. So what we did was, we have 80 volunteers, and we formed a core team comprising myself, Tiffany Jamison, and Susan O'Malley. And what we did was, as a group of 80, we worked over the summer and we wrote this very landmark report, which is now can be read at our ND Gifts Movement website, ND standing for Neurodiverse Gifts Movement. And I think our report's about 70 pages long, but the whole goal of the work was to try and promote innovation at companies by explaining that, on the one hand, whilst most neurodiverse people, or in general, neurodiverse people tend to be extra creative, and at the same time, 80% of people who are neurodiverse are unemployed and 15% are underemployed. So what we were trying to say was that, listen, if a company needs innovation, well, then there's this pool of talent which is either unemployed or underemployed, and that's ready-made talent for anybody who's looking for innovation, so especially the tech companies. So we wrote this landmark report. I think if you read the report, every chapter is written by maybe 5 to 6 people, and everybody being experts in their field. So we had business people, medical people, mental health people, program managers, tech people. It was a very diverse group, both in terms of their functional expertise, but also diverse in terms of, you know, it's a cognitively diverse team, which is pretty rare in the world today, you know, that it was a combination of neurodiverse and neurotypical.
Wow. That is really awesome. Because, like, part of the movement was to make, you know, teams and corporations more cognitively diverse, right? So you were doing that within the project itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we were modeling to companies, listen, this is our team and this is the way we're doing it. So we were kind of, what do they call it, walking the talk or something?
Yeah, like walking the walk, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was really good work. And, you know, there's been some fruits of that work which have made us all pretty pleased. The other thing that happened, I suppose, was whilst originally we planned that it was going to be a short-term innovation sprint, what happened was when we came to publish the report on the 2nd of September 2020, basically we started a LinkedIn site, and that became the focus point for our social movement. So I think today we have roughly 700 people on this LinkedIn site, and it's growing every day. So I suppose something that was meant to be short term and very, you know, there's going to be an end date on it, it's just ended up growing into a social movement, which was not intended at the beginning.
Oh, wow. Okay, so wasn't it intended to be? What was it originally intended, and then what did it become?
It was structured by Stanford Business School as an innovation sprint that would be completed at the end of August, and that'd be the end of it.
Oh, okay. Was Stanford going to like utilize the research or information for?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it's now public. So, I mean, we collaborated with five or six major tech companies and with banks such as Bank of America, and we also collaborated with Microsoft and Amazon in Seattle. And so both Amazon and Microsoft are leaders in the neurodiversity space. So what we did was we collaborated with those companies. Bank of America were a sponsor, by the way, and so is my bank, AIB Bank. But the idea being that we send a report around to all these companies, including the Stanford itself, and through hopefully people reading the report, that's the idea is that they do become more aware just by reading a report.
Yeah, for sure. Have you had any like continuing contact with those companies?
Well, here's the thing. So I suppose some of the things that have come out of it, I mean, this is just, you know, bear in mind, we only finished the work, whatever it is. Is that maybe what, 5 months ago? But yeah. What happened was maybe a month after we completed our report, Goldman Sachs announced neurodiversity internships. So we were very pleased at that.
Wow, I didn't.
Because we had contact with Goldman during the work. The second thing is that Amazon itself is really doing great things in terms of neurodiversity. So like they were people that we did interact with. So it's really good that to see them doing a lot of work in this space. And then companies like LinkedIn is doing this internal neurodiversity training. And then obviously Microsoft continues to do its great work. So yeah, there's I suppose hopefully it's not self-serving to say that our work maybe raised awareness, and these companies probably would have done it anyway, but it's just good to sometimes bring things to the surface a bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think what's one of the things that's really groundbreaking about it is that it's so encouraging to hear neurodivergent people doing this research. And I think that's kind of rare when you talk about like implementation in the, you know, corporate world.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. What was it like?
It's a bit like, but you see, it's a bit like, can you imagine like, I mean, this is true for racial diversity, I think, and gender diversity, but like, can you imagine like, I suppose, maybe 40 years ago, and let's say when a company was hiring women, but let's say they had nobody on the interview panel who was a woman. Or let's say they want to hire a racially diverse group of people and there's nobody on the interview board who's racially diverse. I know, but it shouldn't. But like, it's the same thing for neurodiversity. Like you'll get no, unless, what's this? There's some saying that says, nothing for us without us, or something like that, isn't there? There's some saying like that. It says nothing should be done without us.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm trying to think of it too. I don't know, but
it's like nothing for us without us. I think that's what it is. Something like that.
Sounds good. Yeah, for sure. I'm curious. Is there because I do have a copy of the report, which I'm working through. But as you can imagine,
I know
it takes a little bit. But I'm curious if it seems like a big part of this is focused on recruiting neurodiversity.
I'd say, well, actually, the report has all these different chapters. One's on mental health. One's about how to do internships. One's about, you know, the business case for neurodiversity. One is about all the intersectionalities. You know, the report is deliberately very broad, but I suppose the one of the big issues about a few of the key insights are that, you know, we're trying to encourage companies who are looking for innovation to hire and recruit and train and put in place career paths for neurodiverse people. And what we're also trying to do is to point out that in the vast majority of organizations today, there's no neurodiversity in the actual organizational structure or HR systems. There's no neurodiversity included.
Right, exactly. I'm curious what you think about, or if your report has covered the, I don't want to say challenges, but like the things to consider when retaining neurodivergent individuals. Like, I have a lot of instances where like my ADHD is originally very appealing to employers, right? Like they're like, oh yeah, you're creative, you can think on the spot, whatever. But then keeping me is like, they're like, okay, well, this is kind of more trouble than it's worth. So do you have anything about accommodations?
Well, like I think we don't, the report doesn't have a huge amount about that. But what I think we do talk about, I mean, some of the key things in terms of helping neurodiverse people be successful at work, there's a few kind of key tips. Abby, you probably know these. The first thing is to have the right job role fit. That's the first thing. The second thing is to give accommodations. Third thing then is to have, I think the number one factor that leads to success is having a manager who knows and is aware of how to manage somebody who's neurodiverse, right? And then part of that means giving regular feedback and having a separately designed career plans. And, you know, I don't mean separately, I mean tailored career paths, and I suppose coaches and mentors, and then probably tailored mental health support. So I think they're all the ingredients for success. And there's companies like Bank of America and Microsoft and Amazon that do a great job in those areas. So, you know, for people who want to do it, it can be done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Could you speak a little bit more about what Amazon and Microsoft, for example, or other corporations are doing very well?
Yeah. So I would say what Microsoft do very well is they're very good in having a separately, as Amazon do as well, and Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs, but they have a separately identified, goals and targets for neurodiversity. They recognize neurodiversity as being a diversity in addition to gender and racial, right? And but at the same time, what's really important is that, just like for gender or for racial, it's like everything is integrated. In other words, there's no separation. Like people in the workforce aren't separated into neurodiverse or neurotypical. It's not like even like women over there, men over there. It's the same thing. It's an integrated workforce, but it's one that incorporates element of racial diversity, gender diversity, ethnic, and everything else, and then neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the menu. So those companies that I mentioned, Amazon, Microsoft, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, they're really good at recognizing the need for neurodiversity and having it in their diversity and their diversity reports, and, you know, promoting people and showing examples of it in their work, and having things like, you know, affinity groups, and just generally being supportive of the need for neurodiversity.
Wow. Yeah, that is pretty huge. You don't see that a lot in like those, you know, protection and of discrimination and diversity clauses. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's like even beyond, you know, the way there's the American Disabilities Act, whatever year that was, but like to me, the great things about great companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Goldman Sachs, and who else did I mention? Bank of America, is that they go beyond, let's say, the legal requirements, and they look on people as equal people, and of course we're all different, but it's that whole idea of unity through diversity. You know, we're all the same. Sorry, it's like we're all unique human beings with equal dignity before, you know, the American Constitution, you know, equal before God, but we're all, you know, we're all made uniquely and we're all different. So those companies do an amazing job of recognizing that and building it into their companies. So what I'm trying to say is that there are like purely legal requirements, which are like very, let's say, in America, like the American Disability Act was excellent, but it's kind of like, for me, that's the bare minimum, whereas that's the minimum. But to get true diversity, it means looking as people with equal and diverse.
Yeah. Oh, well said. Very well said. I'm curious, because as opposed to other maybe diversity goals in hiring and things like that, like gender and race, that might be more, I don't know, maybe kind of obvious when you're hiring somebody, but it might not be obvious if they're neurodivergent. So do you recommend that people share that, or is there, what do you see?
Well, and actually there's a big section on that in our report, right? And honestly, like, the truth is, at the moment, the majority of people choose not to disclose. And for all the reasons that are in this section in our report, right? I suppose it's got to do with bias and fear of bias. But I personally would recommend disclosing, because I think it makes life so much better. And one of the things, there's a professor at NYU called Kenji Yoshima, but he talks about, you know, if you're in an organization and you're suppressing your identity, I think you spend like maybe 30% of your day's energy on suppressing your identity. Whereas actually, if you don't, it means everybody gets to know he's a whole human being. So I don't recommend personally not disclosing. In other words, what I'm saying is my recommendation would be to disclose. But obviously, the majority of people don't agree with me at the moment. But that's, but there's a very good section in our report on that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, to be honest, I do generally recommend that people don't disclose in an interview, at least. Just because, you know, like, we are underemployed and
discriminated against.
Yeah, that's a huge, especially there's so many people who just don't understand ADHD.
Yeah, but you know, some though, Abby, the only thing I would say is that in the likes of Goldman Sachs or Microsoft or Amazon or Salesforce or LinkedIn or Bank of America or AIB, I would recommend those companies. Or there's other companies like Ultranauts, and there's a lot of companies like Lime Connect, Ultranauts, Specialist Turn, Oticon, you know, SAP Software, JP Morgan Chase. But if anybody was interviewing at any of those companies, I recommend they definitely would disclose, because those companies are neurodiverse aware.
Oh, that is great advice. How do you
and
know,
supportive.
How do you know if a company has like dedicated, you know, attention to neurodiversity?
Well, the way I find out, honestly, is I just find out through researching their sites, including things like their HR sites. They usually say that, you know, they usually give their hiring policies, and a lot of companies these days have diversity reports and diversity initiatives, and you can pretty much find out pretty quickly.
Yeah, for the big companies, I can imagine. Yeah.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, here's what it comes down to, right? So any company who wants to sell products to its customers in America or anywhere else, right? I mean, you know, this idea that, like, if you're trying to sell products to a customer base, and if your customer base is 20% neurodiverse, right? You should probably have 20% of your staff neurodiverse, you know? or like, for example, if 50% of the world population are women, but then probably 50% of management should be women. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's quite easy on theory, but right, it seems to be very hard to make it work in practice.
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah. Is there any difference between like representation in the US versus Ireland that you've seen?
Well, I would say that for the most part, it's hidden in Ireland, except like, for example, with the American high techs who are here. In my opinion, maybe except for SAP Software and AIB Bank, I think all the leaders in this field are American. I'm just after thinking, Abby, there's two banks in Australia, National Australia Bank and ANZ Bank, who are advised by a company called Untapped, who you probably know, but Andrew Eddy is his name. But Australia are leaders in this work, as are those companies, American companies I mentioned to you. Other than that, though, honestly, like, there's very little awareness in most countries yet of this. And in Ireland, I suppose, we do have the advantage that some of the local high-tech companies like Google or, you know, Amazon or Microsoft are here, and they do promote it through their network here.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's interesting you mentioned Australia. I actually have a very strangely large listener base in Australia.
Yeah, they're very, I mean, like Australia, honestly, because of the work of Andrew Eddy and because of the work of National Australia Bank and ANZ, they're just, I mean, they and American companies are way ahead of everybody else.
Wow, very cool. I actually didn't know that. That's really awesome. You mentioned accommodations being an important piece of retaining neurodivergent people. Do you have any recommended accommodations that you've seen or heard are very helpful?
Well, I mean, you know, Abby, that the accommodations all depends not only on the condition of the person, but also like like, you know, the way there's none of us alike. We're all different. Even ADHDers are all different. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so the accommodations are all very different. I suppose in my case, I need a lot of calm environments. I need calm environments. And I need the ability to brainstorm. I need time to brainstorm. Accommodations, yeah. I mean, probably like yourself, I've, you know, studied a huge amount about accommodations. And the only thing I can say to the subject is that the accommodations will vary according to every individual and according to the condition they have and according to their age and their maturity, you know. So the accommodations for, let's say, a 15-year-old ADHD person will be completely different than, let's say, a 35-year-old ADHD person, you know. And so it's very hard to give a formulaic response.
Yes, yeah, I definitely relate to that.
In the case of dyslexics, obviously, it's more time to read and to write words. I mean, I think a friend who's got dyslexia, he just needs more time to do his exercises. But it just varies.
Yeah, it really does. Something I've noticed is a challenge for, you know, people in the workforce with ADHD in particular, and I imagine autism as well, is that sometimes it's hard I get a lot of people who are like, I'm having a lot hard time at work, but I don't know what to ask for to make it better. And I don't feel safe with my supervisor to brainstorm it. So they kind of ask.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I suppose it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that really, if it's a supportive workplace, to the extent that the neurodiverse person can educate the manager about the condition they have, let's say ADHD, and also their team members, that to me is the biggest plus. If you can build a team environment where everybody in your team and your boss knows the condition you have and the accommodations you need, it can really make for an amazing environment. And it just means also that you end up doing the right job, playing to your strengths.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think that would definitely be ideal. I'm curious, did the movement that, or the project that you were working on, did it either have some ideas for trainings for managers, for example, or do you know any trainings for managers that have been really useful?
Well, I think the trainings for managers, there's one of the, remember I was saying we three members of the team, Tiffany Jamison, Susan O'Malley, and myself, we were kind of like the core three. But Tiffany Jamison has a company called Grit and Flow. And I think she has three or four people working with her, but they do all that work. So I know they've done that for some big clients. So that's one of her specialisms.
Wow, very cool. And what was that Grit, called
again? Grit and Flow, GRIT. And Flow, and it's Tiffany Jamison is the entrepreneur.
Oh, very cool. Okay, maybe I can. Does she have a website that I can link?
Yeah, to? Yeah, or a LinkedIn, or I can introduce Shabby, whatever suits.
Wow, amazing. Trying to decide, there's so much I want to know and I don't know what to ask. Let's see. Well, what's coming to mind is that I'm very curious what it was like for you to work on this big, important project with other neurodivergent people. Like, had you experienced that kind of work environment before? For
No.
me, it would feel very new.
Yeah, it was very new. Like, to be honest, I think it's in the world today, it's very rare.
Hmm.
And it was good because, I think it was good because the project was all about neurodiversity. Everybody on the team, like all 80 of us or more, maybe it was 100 of us, we were all very aware that other people on the team would might have other conditions. Do you know what I mean? So we were all aware, as we got together and wrote parts of the report, we all knew that within the team there's different neurodiverse people. So we never, here's the thing, that we never found a need to find out the detail of all the neurodiversity in the team. It's just like we all just entered the whole spirit of this, think to ourselves, listen, there's people on our teams, the people that we're working with and writing with, who are neurodiverse. So you know what I mean? It was a bit like, it was an overarching thing that we all knew we had to work with that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So like the idea of like just assume that there are people that are going to need...
Yeah. So like in my case, like I knew I had ADHD, but I was saying, yes, this person on this team might have... So it was like the whole culture and the spirit was, listen, this is a cognitively diverse team. Like, not to assume that anybody is neurotypical. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So like, it was good because none of us needed to bother to ask. We all just said, listen, we're a cognitively diverse team. And of course, Abby, as you know, like, really, the truth of it is that even though people would say that there's 20% of the world are neurodiverse, right? Like, the truth is probably everybody has something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's no such thing as the normal, perfect brain. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. That's kind of why I like to use neurotypical instead of normal.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. No, I agree. I agree.
I'm curious. So I know that one of the things that you said was really important to create a business or an environment where cognitive diversity is celebrated and explored is by like being very transparent about being neurodiverse. Whereas it doesn't sound like maybe on your team you saw that as much. So I'm curious, what do you see as like, is there maybe something else about, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I suppose the thing is, you know, in the workplace, when you're doing your day's work, I suppose it's definitely very helpful to know when you're working in very close proximity with people every hour of the day, it's really good to know that. Our project was a bit different because we all worked, you know, literally thousands of them. Like, we're all working over Zoom and we weren't working in close physical proximity. And like, I knew some of the people on the team had certain conditions, but because we were only, let's say, an 8-week or 12-week project, you know, it was a little bit like we all just kind of focused on getting the job done. And, you know, none of us really went into an awful lot of detail with each other about each other's diversity. You know what I mean?
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely. I asked because it sounds like, you know, the culture that you created was very like neurodiverse friendly. And I'm curious, I know this might be hard to define, but can you say what are some of the characteristics about just what made it so welcoming?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a bit like, can you imagine working on a project where the subject is women's rights? Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like when you work on something like a cognitive diversity or the project, like everybody enters the project and everybody's completely bought in to the idea and equality and justice and, you know, treating everybody fairly and recognizing and being aware that we're all different. And I think there's kind of a magic when everybody buys into that culture from the start.
Yeah.
So, for example, can you imagine, like, in any corporation today, if everybody bought into that culture like from the get-go, and there was everybody was completely and utterly committed to that culture. Like, it would solve an awful lot of issues, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I mean, not just neurodiversity, but women's rights, you know, like, you know, racial, ethnic, like, you name it. Like, just, I suppose if everybody could buy into a culture that every human being is equal and is deserving of respect, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I like what you emphasized, just the commitment, you know, knowing that everyone is devoted to,
yeah.
you know, equity and...
yeah. And that's what I see. And here's the thing, you know, the reason I say it's important is because in companies such as Amazon and Microsoft and Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and AIB or, you know, Salesforce, LinkedIn, you can feel that that's the culture from the top. And you see, when it's the culture from the top, it makes all the difference because everybody down the organizational hierarchy kind of says, well, listen, if the top people are saying this is important, then it has to be important for all of us.
Mm. Yes.
And absolutely. That's what makes them great companies. That's the difference, that there's commitment from the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people know it. You know, I mean, here's the thing, like, if there's commitment from the top, everybody knows it. Like, everybody knows it. It's like it becomes in the ether. Like, if somebody, the CEO of, you know, of the CEO of Amazon or Microsoft or Goldman Sachs, if they believe in diversity or Bank of America, it comes through the organization in the way they make products, in the way they approach diversity, in the way they treat people, in the way they, you know, look after customers, their staff, their shareholders, their stakeholders, the community. You know, it's just like it's like, you know, the recent shareholders letters of Larry Fink, who talks about, you know, the need for companies to take account of all their stakeholders in society, including climate change and, you know, reducing emissions. And it's the same thing with your diversity. It's all part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't just run a company for shareholders alone. It needs to be for all stakeholders, including society.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Do you have any... So I think what's cool about your work and the report is that it is kind of directed towards the people with the power, right? You know, the people at the top, yeah. the people making these corporations, which I love. I'm really tired of hearing about like how neurodivergent people can like cater to, you know, that kind of thing. However, I'm wondering if you have maybe any advice for people who are neurodivergent and in the workforce or trying to get into the workforce, any advice?
Yeah. So, you know, I'd say I have two bits of advice. One is to seek to work in those companies that are supportive of neurodiversity. The second thing then is to disclose your neurodiversity at the time of interviewing. So only work with companies who are supportive of neurodiversity and disclose your neurodiversity when you're interviewing. And that just means right from the start of the game, you know, you're going to bring your whole self and identity to work. And you can be your authentic self. And you don't have to spend 30% of your psychic energy every day suppressing your identity.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, that would be the dream. And you work in a bank now, right?
Yeah.
Is there, do you have any just little nuggets about like what about your ADHD makes you great at your job, or maybe what accommodations you have there that make it really friendly for your ADHD?
Yeah, I'd say the single biggest thing for me about my particular version of ADHD combined type is that I'm incredibly creative. So I'm really good at strategy and macro trends and identifying, you know, patterns and trends and links between, let's say, you know, links between sustainability and business model and climate change and diversity and making those links between different domains, you know, connecting the dots. And so that's my greatest strength. And the thing about my company is the company allows me to do a role that plays to my strengths.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, very cool. Did you want to circle back to your book and talk a little bit more about that, or?
Yeah, I don't mind. I'll tell you, my book, I'm working with a ghostwriter at the moment, and it's probably going to cover, you know, the period, obviously, from my childhood up to attending Stanford Business School. And, you know, in the book, I'll talk about, you know, what it's like when you think different. So, you know, it's like the Apple, remember the Apple brand promotion, think different. So I think people who have neurodiverse minds tend to think differently. And the thing about thinking differently, as you probably know, Abby, is that it's really good if you're in the right environment. But if you're in a school or a college or a company that doesn't value think differently, sometimes there could be bias. So, you know, that'll be one part of the book, but probably should circle back with you again maybe next January, because then I'll have the whole book written. And but that's kind of a little bit of a taste of it.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I would definitely be interested in reading something like that, especially like someone's experience growing up in another country with ADHD. I think that's can be very different.
Yeah, and that's why I think, I suppose, here's the thing that, at least to my knowledge, the US is probably the best country on the planet to grow up if you have a condition. You know, I know the UK is quite good too, but honestly, I don't know. Other than the US and the UK, I don't know of any other countries that are good at this. Maybe France and maybe some Nordic countries. I'm not sure, but certainly I think that probably Australia is very good. But to my knowledge, it's US, UK, Australia, and I don't know who else after that.
And do you have a sense of why that is?
Because I think that's I'm only guessing here, Abby, but I suspect that the whole field of psychiatry and medical research was probably originated in the US, I suspect. That's a guess. I don't know.
Yeah. A lot of the innovation and new research.
Like, I know in the ADHD, there was the famous author and psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School, you know, he wrote the book, Driven to Distraction, by John Rady and what's his other name? Dr. Ed Halliwell and Dr. John Rady of Harvard Medical School. To my knowledge, they were one of the pioneers maybe 20 years ago. But there's people as well in the US, like there's people like there's a guy, a psychologist I came across recently who's written a lot of books.
Barclay,
Dr. Russell Barclay. Like he's like amazing. And then there's people like Melissa Orlov who concentrate on marriage. And then there's a lot of writers in this area. And there's a lot of, I think in the States, there's a growing number of psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists and counselors and mentors and coaches. So I think America is leading the way, I think, at the moment.
Wow, that's kind of cool to hear. I'm glad to get that perspective, because I know a lot of times, just, you know, being in the U.S. and being kind of entrenched in this, we can sometimes get bogged down with how far behind it can feel, right? With people with ADHD and just especially like medical professionals just not understanding it. And so that's really good perspective to acknowledge how many people we have who are doing the right stuff.
I think you were just going back to something you said earlier on, that when you mentioned about the support in the workplace, obviously mental health is huge area for everybody, but I think there's very specific needs for neurodiverse people. And like, I've had two experiences of depression, which I didn't even know were depression. Mm-hmm. So I think people who are neurodiverse tend to be very vulnerable to anxiety and depression.
Yes.
So that'd be one of the areas to watch out for in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen anything that's especially helpful support in the workplace for anxiety?
I think just really the provision of really good therapists and counselors and psychologists. Yeah. Medical professionals.
Yeah. I like that. I think it's a good overall point that, like, a huge part of making your workforce, you know, neurodiverse friendly is healthcare, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that we have access to healthcare.
Yeah.
I like that, seeing it as a diversity issue. Very good. So I have like a topic or I have thoughts swirling around in my head that I'm wanting your perspective on.
Yeah.
So lately I've been thinking a lot about just the sometimes feeling conflicting perspectives on neurodivergence, specifically like ADHD and autism.
Yeah.
In terms of like people viewing it as a disability versus like as a strength, like put simply, you know, like
there's, yeah,
it's very fascinating discourse that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like on both sides. And I'm very curious for your perspective on this discussion, considering
yeah.
that.
But I suppose here's the thing. So the way I look on myself, right, is that I say, God, I'm very grateful for being given special talents, right? And of course, it's just that the flip side of that is that I tend to be distractible and impulsive. So, you know, some people say, oh, well, that means you have a disability. But the way I see it myself personally is that it's like two sides of a coin. I'm so incredibly grateful for the gifts that, like, I don't mind at all. The flip side, having to put up with distractibility and impulsivity. So, yeah, I suppose it is true that, you know, kids and children at school need accommodations because of, let's say, the disability associated with distractibility, inattention, or impulsivity. But as you get older, certainly the way I feel now is I'm so thankful that I was given ADHD myself, because they're just incredible strengths.
Yes. So do you have any like any reaction to being told or thinking like you have a disability? Do you like disagree with that?
I think originally I did. I mean, originally I got upset when somebody called me disabled. Mm-hmm. I got very upset. But then I calmed down because the person who said it to me was a medical professor at Stanford, who pointed out that people with ADHD do have certain disabilities, you know, according to the medical, you know, notebook, right? So, yeah, so, I mean, I calmed down because I suppose for me, when he called me disabled, I took it as a negative thing. But he was just purely given a clinical, medical, you know, professional. He said, why are you getting so upset? He says, is it or is it not true that you have a disability in certain areas? I said, it's true. And then he said to me, well, then why are you getting upset about it? You know, I said, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, though, because I see that a lot. I mean, it's what fascinates me about this discussion is how strongly people tend to feel one way or the other.
Yeah.
And like, I know some people with ADHD who feel very hurt by like the
yeah.
implication that they have a disability, and then other people might say like, yes, I it's really important to me to think about this as a disability. I mean, for one, because of how trivialized ADHD is and
yeah.
how it's kind of just treated flippantly, and like, you
yeah.
know, it's just, oh, you just, you know, you doze off some or you zone out sometimes, you know, it's much, much more than that. So
yeah.
some people feel that way, and then that some people say like, well, I mean, exactly what you said, like, how is disability a bad thing? I mean, it's just
yeah.
You know, why are you distancing yourself from that term?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, the truth is, like, Abby, like, you know, I don't know, but I'm guessing like probably most people in the world have some type of disability. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you know, and you know something, like, I think it's almost 100% true that 100% of people will at some stage in their life experience disability.
Mm.
Like we're all going to die, you know? So like, why don't, like, it's better to wake up to that fact, you know, as we live life, that we're all going to be disabled, even if we're not currently.
Yes. Yeah. That is a really good point. Yeah.
And what does disabled mean anyway? Like I know some people that might have a disability in A, but they're their Olympic standard in B, C, and D. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you'd
yeah.
even take the Paralympics and somebody like an Olympic gold medal. Yeah, let's say they have a disability, but my God, they're Olympic gold medalists. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy.
Or like, you know, do you remember the guy in the wheelchair, the great, what was it, the guy in the wheelchair in England? He was a great professor, a great inventor, and what was his name?
Hawking? Stephen Hawking?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like some people might say, oh yeah, he's disabled. Other people say he's not disabled at all. Like, he's amazing.
Mm.
Well, you know, he's disabled, but my God, he's off the charts. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big fan of turning butts into ands, you know, yeah, like, kind of like, yeah, being disabled and having incredible talent.
Exactly,
not,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Not despite it, or, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And it's something that I think about a lot, because I don't know if you've seen this as well, but I see Dr. Halliwell and Dr. Barkley as very interesting, like they're both doing incredible work and a lot of their research agrees with each other. But
yeah.
I hear a lot of people saying, well, Dr. Barkley is too deficit focused. Like, he's like all about, like, you know, talking about the executive functioning deficits,
yeah,
and ADHD is a very severe disability that lowers your lifespan. And then like Dr. Halliwell is all about like, no, this is a great thing. This,
yeah,
great,
I know.
News. You know, it's so,
yeah, I think it's good to read both. I like reading both.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I learn from both.
Yes, agreed.
I think they're both great.
Anything else that you were thinking
about? Abby, you've done a very good job. I think that's as much, I think everything, an awful lot of what I know about neurodiversity and ADHD you now have asked me, and, you know, maybe we should talk again. Like, I'm hoping I get the book published this, the end of this year, but maybe watch out, and whenever I get it published, then we could do another interview, and I could talk a lot more about it.
Oh yeah, I would love that. I mean, I would love a link or a title if you can think to send,
yeah,
it to me. But I'm sure that you'll be busy.
Yeah, we don't. It's still in the works. So I'll be much better able to talk to you in December of this year.
Okay, nice, awesome. Yeah, we'll check back in. Any remaining thoughts or
a couple of things, I suppose. Firstly, like, I suppose anybody who follows your show is to, you know, I would definitely recommend and hope that they might read our report on Andy Gift's movement, and then to join the movement. And I know Tiffany Jamison and Susan O'Malley are still very involved, and I'll try to be involved as much as I can. I'm pretty busy with my banking job in the book, but it's a great movement, and just anybody you know who's interested in this topic, the more people we have in the movement and trying to help, I think it's especially good, Abby, because in Seattle you have both Amazon and Microsoft, who are, you know, probably two of the best five companies in the planet at this.
Wow.
So, yeah, you're so lucky.
Wow, that's so interesting. I'm curious to, like, what the Seattle listeners will think of that. I think we, as, like, locals, we see a lot of maybe the downside of having such, you know, behemoth companies in our backyard.
But they do great things for neurodiversity, both,
yeah,
of them. Great,
yeah,
things. Really, like, you know something, if the rest of the world and even governments, if companies and governments adopted the same policies as Amazon and Microsoft, we'd all be a lot better off.
Wow, yeah. You mentioned that it'd be good for people to get involved in the movement. What's the best,
yeah,
way for people to get involved? What kind of?
Well, I suppose join the LinkedIn site, and Tiffany Jamison is the person who's, let's say, organizing the leadership. So it's to, I suppose, link in with the, you know, and there's various people in, I think they have a leadership group in America. And I think the goal is that over the next 3 months or 6 months, they might do another publication. So anybody who has, I suppose, passion and commitment, you know, there's definitely an open door.
Wow, awesome. Okay, yeah, the LinkedIn group, and then the grit and flow, is that what
is Tiffany Jamison? Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
great.
But for anybody who wants to, let's say, commit time and energy and interest, that definitely, it's a great, I mean, I had a great time being involved, and I will be involved again. Yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe at the end of next year. No, maybe at the end of this year. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I will definitely check that out. And I'll put the link for the report and your website in the
right
show notes in the website. So That'll be great. And anything else that if people want to connect with you, they can look
for? Yeah, I mean, I've got my own LinkedIn, yeah. And yeah, I mean, I just encourage everybody to make, you know, to just as in the case of racial equity or gender equity, to also include cognitive diversity or neurodiversity, just to not forget it in the whole. Obviously, like, it is a priority right now for understandable reasons, racial equity and gender equity, but it's just not to forget about cognitive diversity.
Yeah, and exactly what you said, it's all connected, right? It's very intersectional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, nothing for us without us.
Nothing for us without us.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ronan McGovern. If people want to look you up, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Abby. It was great.
Conversation.
It's been great. Thanks, Abby. Thanks so much for your work.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
That's all for this episode, but there is plenty more at my website, theadhdmanual.com. That's theadhdmanual.com. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit at The ADHD Manual. Do you have a question, comment, or story? Then I want to hear it. Email me at theadhdmanual@gmail.com. Very special thank you to my brother, Joe Miner, for composing this theme music, and thank you so much for listening. And remember to be kind to yourself. See you next time.